Hello and welcome to the Beyond Biotech podcast number 63. I'm Jim Cornell and this is the weekly LaBiotech podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Vetter, a globally leading contract development and manufacturing organization with over 70 years of experience as a responsible independent family business. Driven by more than 6,000 employees worldwide, we provide, together with our customers, life-saving injectable drug products to the patients that rely on them most. We partner with our customers from Phase 1 through market launch and beyond, supporting them with our versatile services, highest possible quality standards, and innovative production technologies. For more information, visit us at vetter-pharma.com. So, what's been happening this week? Well, not much really. A little bit of planning because events have started up again after the summer, and so I'm sure there are plenty of you out there putting itineraries together for various trips. It's funny how in the spring I ended up going to Liverpool twice in a week, and the last time I was there was 1984. Similarly, the last time I was in Munich was 1983, and it looks like I'll be there twice in November. I'm sure it hasn't changed a bit in 40 years. Not that I can really remember that much about it anyway. And so today's podcast number 63 goes out on September the 15th, although of course you may be listening to this after it was published. It's not like live radio, which I do miss, I must say. So September the 15th is Greenpeace Day, Caregivers Day, Cheese on Toast Day, Tackle Kids Cancer Day, and 8-Track Tape Day. I was wondering exactly what you would do with that one. No one has an 8-track player anymore, do they? I remember, and this is going to make me feel really old, but my first ever ride in a car, it had an 8-track in it. It was Boxing Day and my then brother-in-law took me in his Ford Capri to get petrol or gas, and he was playing in Gordon Lightfoot's band at the time, and when I got in the car, Sundown was playing. Funny how you remember some things from your childhood, but I have no idea what I did yesterday. In science, it's the day a patent was filed for saccharin, and also the day the first weather balloon was launched. It's the day the first railway was opened in the UK, and it's also the day of the first railway fatality, because it happened at the same event. And it's also the day that the term bacteriophage was used for the first time, at least as far as we know. The person who coined the phrase in 1917, Dr. Felix Derel, might have mentioned it to his wife the day before. Or maybe she suggested it. Regardless, let's move on to today's podcast, which doesn't involve bacteriophages. Cancer dysregulation affects a large network of cellular signaling pathways, resulting in tumour progression. The complexity of these pathways limits the long-term benefits of therapies, and that often results in resistance and adverse effects that can significantly affect patients' quality of life. To tackle this challenge, Effector Therapeutics is spearheading a novel approach to targeted therapies by depriving cancer cells of essential proteins. They use small molecule selective translation regulation inhibitors, also known as STRIs, to selectively prevent the overproduction and critical cancer-causing proteins, which are activated by highly validated cancer pathways. To explain it all to us much better than I ever could is Effector Therapeutics CEO Steve Worland. All right, so I guess to get things rolling, I wonder if you could first give me a little bit of background on the company?
Yeah, sure. The company is called Effector Therapeutics. We were founded 11 years ago using technology out of UCSF. Our academic founders are Kevan Shokat, who's quite a prolific company starter, and his colleague Davide Ruggiero. And we had an idea, the three of us really, about how to regulate production of really and stop the overproduction of certain proteins that are essential for cancers to grow. And so that was sort of the start of the company. And we invented three different candidates that hopefully will become products that are currently in development to treat different types of tumors, and are busy working on two of those. The third one, we did a licensing deal with Pfizer on that one.
You said UCSF, and yet you're in San Diego. Is there?
Yeah, well, so I had a team here in San Diego that we were kind of looking for our next thing. I'd run a company and sold that company to Roche in 2011, and was looking for kind of what to do next, particularly in cancer. I was fairly agnostic to where the academic science came from. So I actually went around the country. I went to all the top-notch academic universities on the East Coast and the West Coast looking for the most exciting thing I could find. And it happened to be at UCSF. I didn't actually know the founders before we started talking, but we very quickly kind of knew that a team I had here in San Diego and what they were working on was going to be a good match. And so we came together and formed the company.
What are some of the challenges in tackling cancer that you're trying to address? Because clearly there are so many different forms of cancer and so many challenges involved.
Yeah, and I think that's really spot on with why we started the company. The real challenge that I saw was the complexity of cancer. And you mentioned there are several different kinds of cancer. Even within what we would call one type of cancer, there's quite a bit of genetic diversity and what we call plasticity, meaning the cancer can really morph back and forth. If you think about a treatment as kind of putting pressure on the cancer, it can kind of dodge and go a different direction. I'd spent about 10 years working mostly in the antiviral area. So first, way back in my career, I worked on everything as a kind of a generalist, including cancer. Then I focused on antivirals, first HIV and then hepatitis C. And the real answer to both of those diseases was you got to play chess with the disease, anticipate what the disease will do. I hit this target, it's going to evolve, it's going to mutate, it's going to do that. If I hit this target, then that target, then that target. You could begin to actually see what in chess they call the game tree. You could see how the disease will respond to one type of therapy and how could I complement that and kind of box it into a corner. I'd say in HIV, we've at least boxed it into a corner. Now there's long-term, relatively effective care. And in hepatitis C, for 95% of patients, we beat the disease. Most patients, almost all patients, you can eradicate what was a chronic viral infection. And the thinking here was really, how is the disease going to respond to our therapy? So now you have to amp the complexity up by a factor of 10, maybe more, maybe a factor of 50 for cancer. But that same idea that, you know, there were some remarkable successes in cancer, targeted therapies like Gleevec and Herceptin. And then when people tried to take those concepts to other types of tumors, they found resistance developed quite quickly for most what we call targeted therapy. And so our thinking was, okay, let's acknowledge that's part of the disease. It is very complex. It's very agile and can squirm out from under our treatment. So let's anticipate that and let's think about our therapy. And so that fundamentally, that was the issue with the complexity that leads to resistance developing to therapy. How can we anticipate that ahead of time? And we were really looking for a way to try to address that complexity. And so because the complexity of the cancer allows or enables the cancer to evolve and develop resistance to one type of therapy. And so one of the ways it does that is to rely on several different factors. And so going back to, you know, starting the company, the idea was to block the overproduction of several factors at the same time. And therefore, I'll never say we eliminate the possibility of resistance, but at least slow it down and make it harder for the cancer to develop resistance. And maybe you can, the immune system can kick in and actually eradicate the tumor, but at a minimum, try to extend the benefit much longer time that people can treat the cancer or experience the cancer as a long-term chronic treatable disease instead of a short-term death sentence.
Could you maybe explain a little bit about the role of proteins in cancer and how you deprive cancer cells of those essential proteins and sort of what STRIs are and how they work?
Yeah, for sure. So let's start with a couple of basic ideas. So DNA, of course, is the kind of the code of life. And so people now know that we sequenced the human genome about 20 years ago now and did viruses and bacteria before that. So that's DNA. And I think everybody knows about protein and the protein that we eat. And turns out proteins are the workhorses inside a cell. Most of the functions that a cell has to carry out are executed by specific proteins. And these would be things like hemoglobin or I'm trying to think of protein someone might have heard of it. Hemoglobin carries oxygen around in your blood. You think about a protein like an insulin receptor, recognizes insulin and tells cells what to do with the sugar molecules. So DNA, again, code of life, protein, the workhorses in the cell. In between those two is another species called RNA. So RNA is related to DNA, but with a slight chemical difference. And so the information in the DNA is read, or we say transcribed, into the RNA. And then the information in the RNA is then translated into a protein sequence. And so we're working on that second step called translation, which is basically taking the information in the genome that's been rewritten as RNA and then reading that into a directions to a factory inside a cell to make proteins. I'll give you just a little bit of history. So when I, started, moving into molecular biology now, my goodness, 40 years ago, transcription was the hot thing. Everybody thought, oh, we've understood gene expression and all the action happens at transcription, making RNA. And translation is kind of boring. Everybody's known about that. That's how you make the protein. That's housekeeping function. And for 95% of the proteins in a cell, that's true. All the actions at transcription, once the cell has taken the steps to transcribe the DNA, the protein's going to get made. But there's a very small set of proteins, and these are important proteins that really have a profound effect on the cell's behavior. There's a second set of instructions that needs to be read. There's a second sort of gate you have to get over called translation. And the cell has evolved so that those proteins only get made if there's specific conditions where those proteins should be made. And again, that's because these proteins drive cells to divide and they drive cells to migrate to other parts of the body, both of which are central to cancer. And what cancer cleverly has done is sort of hijack that translation function. And it's continually making these many proteins that allow cells to divide. It allows cells to avoid cell death, which is a natural thing that a cancer cell should go kill itself. Cancers override that signal, allow cells to start migrating to other parts of the body, which create metastases. So cancer has perpetually upregulated this overproduction of proteins. And what our molecules do, our STRIs, they actually intervene there and stop cancer cells from exploiting that overproduction mechanism. And we can tamp it back down. We actually don't shut off production entirely. That would be more like a toxic chemotherapy. What we do is just work on that overproduction, that last little bit that lets a normal cell become a cancer cell. We block that part of translation, and then the tumor can't grow and the tumor can't avoid its own death signals.
How does this work in terms of the way that it's delivered to the body?
Yeah, so we have two different product candidates now in clinical development. One of them is a small oral pill. And so you would swallow that twice a day. You take it, with your meals, sort of, breakfast and dinner kind of thing. That product candidate now is in what we call phase 2B. So it's in a randomized study against placebo. The other one is an IV product. And so that's delivered over about 45 minutes. Right now, we're looking at once every 2 weeks. So not too inconvenient there if you can take a week off and then come back in and relatively short infusion time. It's not like an 8-hour kind of chemotherapy or something. And so that one's delivered by IV. And then both of them very quickly distribute throughout the whole body and, of course, get taken up by the tumor cells and have their effect inside the tumor cells.
Does it need to be repeated, or is it once it's done its thing, then you're good?
No, right now we're repeated really until the cancer grows. And so it's very hard to know very generally when to stop cancer therapy, because if it's working, if you block the tumor, there are instances where we know the immune system has taken over and you actually can stop therapy because you now have your own immune system, knows your own tumor and can eradicate it. Those are still quite rare. And so generally, cancer therapy is taken for as long as the tumor is under control. It's not growing in the patient. Hopefully it's shrunk typically. And for our drugs as well, people would continue taking these until there's a safety signal, which I'll come back to in a minute, or until the tumor, unfortunately, ultimately becomes resistant and starts growing again. Because it is long-term chronic therapy, the safety profile is very important as well. Not just straight on like medical safety, but also just the convenience of taking it. And if you're not technically sick, but you feel like crap all the time, you feel, nausea, vomiting, that's not good. So we've really tried to make sure that we find doses and what we call regimens, how often you take it, that are well tolerated and easy for the patients to take. Because, the big idea here is to let a patient with cancer almost forget they have cancer. They're going to have to stay on therapy, but you don't want their therapy to constantly remind them by how horrible they feel taking the therapy that they have cancer. You want them to go on with their life and, check in obviously with their doctors periodically, but hopefully keep the cancer at bay for a long time and make it more like a chronic treatable disease than a short-term sentence.
What kind of cancers is this approach applicable to?
Yeah, so I would say probably quite broadly from our understanding and the work we've done to date, we're really focusing on two types of cancer. So for the first product called tamibosertib. That's the oral pill. That one we're focusing in non-small cell lung cancer. And that one we're actually combining with a drug from Merck called Keytruda, which is the best drug in non-small cell lung cancer today. And we're combining with that and trying to extend that benefit. And then the second product we call Zotadifin, or we call it Zota for short. We're testing that in breast cancer right now. So both of these, lung cancer and breast cancer, very large patient populations who are suffering from those diseases, very significant death rates from both of those as breast cancer gets later stage metastatic, and lung cancer right off the bat. Typically, it's already metastatic when it's diagnosed. And so those are the two, lung cancer and breast cancer, that we're focused on. I do believe with success in those two, we could expand both of the products into other tumor types as well.
And ultimately, you're mentioning how you want people to be feeling okay and not feeling horrendous about not only the cancer, but the treatment. Is this moving towards curing or just maintaining as a chronic disease that you can maintain for 20 years and die of something else, I guess?
Yeah. So I think that's one of the critical questions in cancer is, could you stop therapy? I think right now the conservative thought is find well-tolerated drugs and patients would stay on those drugs. Typically, clinical trials don't test for more than a couple of years, typically. So the FDA labels and European EMA labels would typically say, you know, indicated for 2 years. But most of the time, physicians and patients don't want to stop the therapy. So, 20 years, of course, is a long, long time. But the idea is probably take it for as long as you can and keep the cancer at bay for as long as possible. Ultimately, as the immune system kicks in, there is some hope that patients can sort of educate their own immune system against their tumor and then maybe stop therapy. And if it flares up just a little bit, your immune system can recognize that and eliminate it. There is some evidence for that, but I think that's still early days to think about a fixed treatment, and then you can stop and hopefully never have it come back or monitor. Another intermediate idea is to stop the therapy after some period of time, but then monitor periodically, and then if it comes back, you can jump back in and treat again. So that may be a step on the way towards true cures, where you could walk away and say, I don't need to worry about that again. That would be fantastic to get there, but there's probably an intermediate step on the way to that.
You were mentioning at the beginning about the analogy with chess. Is there a danger that in spite of what you're doing, that the cancer can adapt and circumvent what you're doing?
There is. There's always that chance. And I think because of that cancer complexity. So we actually try to anticipate it. That's, again, part of sort of the disease is, quote, smart as well, but trying to anticipate what the tumor might be. So we think a lot about combination therapy. Mostly this will be used in combination with other drugs, and even understanding how a tumor might become resistant to our drug could suggest another combination we could do. Or one of the most important things you can do is kind of as a legacy thing, if our drug treats your cancer and then you become resistant, if we understand that resistance, we could suggest what the next therapy might be as well. Okay, so a different protein has now come up. Unfortunately, we can't control that. But if there's a drug that could treat that, knowing that ahead of time, to have a patient ready to move on to a different type of therapy. So a lot of what we do is, we analyze our successes in great detail. Why did this patient respond? But we also analyze our failures, both upfront and when a patient is responding and then becomes resistant. We try to sequence their tumors, and you can now sequence tumor cells circulating in blood, or tumor DNA actually circulating in blood. So it's very important to have enough realistic view and enough humility to say the cancer is going to try hard to get back at and overcome our drug. How could that happen? And what could we do for that patient at that point? Could we add on a new drug or switch to a different drug? But have that knowledge already being part of our understanding early in clinical development. And again, I think that's a lesson we learned very strongly in HIV. And then hepatitis C was a little easier to get rid of. But in HIV, knowing what to do next was one of the critical things early on in therapy, where the drugs were working, but they were working for 6 months or a year. And well, now what do we do? Okay, well, then you do this, and then you do that. And then ultimately, we came up with regimens that we pushed that question out. What are we going to do in 10 years, in 15 years? And so that's the hope with cancer, that as we understand how the cancer reacts to our drug, we can then begin to push out that time and be ready with the next treatment course as the cancer, if it does become resistant.
So it's not just a case of understanding your own product. You also have to understand other products in order to be able to use them together, but also for potential future use.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard for the last 20 years, this is the best time to be working in cancer. I think that's true every year when somebody new says it, but there's remarkable advances happening across the industry and across academics and with, government sponsorship for basic research and the industrial research that happens. So, it's a fascinating time to pay attention to how quickly new ideas are coming forward. And then also to think about a more holistic treatment perspective. We're going to probably come after something. We're probably not going to be the first drug that somebody takes when they get diagnosed with cancer, at least, when we would first hopefully get approved, but then also what will come after us. And then, understanding that landscape and understanding how the different treatment choices at different stages of cancer, how that will change over time, is really critical for doing the best job. And, I'll say, it may sound a little corny, but I think we at the company, we feel a responsibility, of course, to the patients and almost to the drugs and to cancer development broadly to do the best job possible. And so to do that, you really need to understand the entire landscape. We fit in part of a very big, constantly changing environment of cancer therapy. And to do the best by the patients, meaning offering the best treatment that our drugs could possibly offer to anybody, it's central to that to understand everything that's going on in therapy. And so that's both very fun to have that continuing learning, but also very important for kind of doing right by the patient and doing right by the drugs that we've invented.
Because of all of the developments and advances, and every year there's something new, does that make it challenging for clinical trial design if there are so many different things going on?
It does, Jim, and a couple of levels. And so there are a lot of treatments being tested, especially in lung cancer, because that's such a big disease. And even the best therapies today, on average, give maybe, 6 to 9 months of good control. And then on average, resistance starts developing again. But because of that, there's lots of products being tested in cancer. And so there's frankly, a competition for patients and a competition for the best cancer treatment centers to get the attention of those people. And then there's both the complexity of what you might add to, and then even from a regulatory point of view, if you're, kind of walking down a path to register your drug, and then in combination with something else, you need to understand, would something else come in front and be better than what you're combining with? Even worse, would the drug you're combining with somehow fall off the way and not be a part of an approved FDA regimen? So it does make it difficult. And you just have to, again, as part of that constant awareness, you have to constantly be thinking about not just what are we trying to prove today, but then what, how is this leading to a registration path? Meaning, how could we get FDA approval, EMA approval? And what are the potential risks for that? And one of the biggest risks is, a changing treatment landscape where another therapy comes in, or as I said, the therapy you're using somehow falls out of favor. So yeah, that's one of the biggest challenges we face.
Quite often, the public especially probably thinks that once you start a clinical trial, you just run it to the end and that's the end of it. But clearly, there are nuances along the way that you have to take care of.
No, absolutely. Because at the end of it, if it's successful and if it's a, registration enabling trial, meaning you're going to take the data to the FDA, they're going to look at everything that happened in the couple of years that you were running that trial and weigh your results in the context of everything that's happened, including things that happened after you started the trial. So it's absolutely the case that you need to anticipate that. And then, it can be nervous times if you're in the middle of a big registration trial and that nothing comes and upsets the apple cart. There are certainly known examples where people developed successful phase three trials ready to go to FDA, and there's no point in taking it to the FDA because it's been superseded by something else in the marketplace. And yes, that's technically a successful trial, but it's not an important trial anymore because something else has superseded what you were testing against.
And where are you currently at with your own trials?
We're in what is called phase two right now. That means, so we've done some exploratory work in phase one. We've identified the dose. We have identified the tumor. So right now we're in phase two trials. And the point there is to, convince ourselves and convince patients, physicians, and ultimately the capital markets that these drugs, are working and they have a good chance. And then we move into phase three to seek registration or approval for to market the drugs.
the registration process? Are you working, or will you be working towards the US alone, or EU, Japan?
Yeah, no, I think typically we would want to involve the EU and Japan as well. And so our thought right now is our registration trials would be what are called global. That's a little bit of a narrow perspective. Global really means, US and North America, Europe, Japan for sure, maybe some in South America. Unfortunately, the way development goes right now, we don't reach some of the other parts of the world. For example, in Africa, that's not typically part of it. China comes and goes. Sometimes it's part of registered global plans. Then it became China only. Then the FDA said that's too much China only data. So it's back to looking more incorporating them globally. But the point being, there are obviously limitations. Some parts of the world don't get to experience or participate in those trials right now as we try to get the drugs approved. But hopefully then there's an opportunity to expand access as broadly as possible.
Clearly, you can't guarantee anything, but what kind of timelines are you working on at the moment?
Yeah, so we're hoping to start our registration trials in the, let's say early 2025 timeframe. So a little more than a year from now, but not much longer than that. So really take the rest of this year understanding our data and next year to get ready to start phase three trials. It's a big endeavor. It's like, sorry to use a militaristic term, but I've heard of, the analogy drawn to the Normandy invasion. I mean, a global phase three trial is a big endeavor. So it takes, several quarters to interact with the regulatory agencies, get everything up and going. But, we're targeting early 2025, maybe the very end of 2024 for one of the drugs to start those trials. And then those would typically run about 2.5 years or so on average. And then you need to collect the data and submit it to the agencies. So.
And as you said, just getting a clinical trial together is not as straightforward as it would seem. It's not that you just say, okay, we're going into phase three trials and you just start one. You've got the recruitment, and that can be a challenge too.
Yeah, and you have the sites, you want to identify good sites. And for a phase three trial, there's a blend of very academically oriented, what are called tertiary treatment centers, where you have the thought leaders, but then you also have community practices. Most cancer patients are treated in what we call the community, smaller practices that aren't necessarily at the, Harvard, Dana-Farber's, Memorial Sloan Kettering, Stanford's, MD Anderson's of the world. You love to start your trials there because you're right at the cutting edge of understanding. But again, most cancer patients are treated in more smaller centers in the community. And so you need a good mix of both of those types. And that's just in the United States. And then you go to Europe and Japan and treatment is provided differently there. And so you need to factor all of that in and really establish good relationships with the sites and with the clinical study coordinators there. So there's the MDs, but there's also the people who actually get the patients into the trial. And all of that's a very big logistical operation on top of the scientific and medical connections and thinking that needs to go into the trials.
Is it important to get diversity in trials in terms of gender, age, race?
Yeah, it's critical for a couple of reasons. One, again, we're in mission to try to treat humans with disease. So that includes all the people. Just from a first principles point of view, you want to provide the therapy as much as possible. And if there are any differences in one group or another, you want to understand that early and try to provide the benefit as broadly as possible. And of course, the regulatory agencies now have made a big deal of this, as I believe they should. They've understood that treatment historically has too much been focused on very narrow groups. And so it's part of their expectation that you'll show them how you're including both genders and also people of different backgrounds in the trials. Pediatrics as well, what is your plan to test your drug in younger children? So the agencies now have made it a expectation, in fact, a requirement of clinical development that you'll address this. You go back to the fundamental mission of the company. That's not adverse to our mission. It's just something that maybe the industry needed a little prodding from the agencies to say, you're here to treat disease, treat everybody who, potentially treat everybody who has the disease, not just the narrow segment that historically clinical trials have focused on.
You were saying earlier about how it's an exciting time to be in cancer research. Clearly, you're very hopeful about the future.
Yeah, I would say that I am. Again, I think you have to have the perspective that this is a deadly disease and people are dying all the time. But I think we are making remarkable progress. Again, I've been in the industry now almost 40 years, and I really went back into cancer 10 years ago because it felt very much like antivirals did in the mid 90s. I didn't recognize it at the time, but I remember how all the pieces were starting to come together. I'll overuse my chess analogy. We finally knew how all the pieces moved on the board. Okay, let's start playing a game. So 10 years ago, cancer really felt that way. It's like, oh, we're finally understanding it was, human genome kind of 2000, war on cancer, going back to Nixon in the 70s. It's very hard. It's very complex, but it really felt like we actually kind of understand the disease. Now we have to go invent therapies and test them, and they won't all work. But I am very hopeful that I think we do understand a lot more about cancer's complexity. And not just that it is complex, but we've taken the complexity apart. We've understood the interaction between tumors and the immune system, which is critical, the other major advance in therapy, in addition to targeted therapy. So I actually am very hopeful that we understand so much more about the disease. We have so many different ways of inventing products now, and not just small molecules, but we have, RNA and DNA therapies. We have cell-based therapies. So we still have a ways to go, but it feels so different than it did, in the 90s when I worked on cancer. It was like, try to kill the tumor cells before you kill all the other cells in the body and come up with things that kill cells. And hopefully we'll find a little bit of a window. In retrospect, that was, far too simple an understanding of the disease. So I am very hopeful that we've picked apart all the knowledge, and now we're in that phase of reassembling things. And as you reassemble and you invent something and you test it and you go, it kind of works like what we thought it might work. That's a signal to say, okay, we understand the rules of the game now. Probably haven't figured out every last little trick in cancer's book yet. And, it's a formidable foe, and we're going to have to keep fighting for a while. But I feel like the industry broadly and academics were so much more empowered than we were before in order to understand cancer. And that's the first step towards actually being able to come up with successful treatments.
Hopefully working towards that checkmate then.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. At least a stalemate. Right? We'll take a stalemate probably, but checkmate would be better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's getting better anyway, that's for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Great to hear more ways in which cancer is being targeted. Certainly learned a lot from Steve in that conversation. And just a reminder that this podcast is sponsored by Vetter, a globally leading contract development and manufacturing organization with over 70 years of experience as a responsible, independent family business. Driven by more than 6,000 employees worldwide, we provide, together with our customers, life-saving injectable drug products to the patients that rely on them most. We partner with our customers from phase one through market launch and beyond, supporting them with our versatile services, highest possible quality standards, and innovative production technologies. For more information, visit us at vetterpharma.com. That's Vetter, VETTER-pharma.com. Right, I better get ready for a trip next week, one where I have 45 minutes between getting off one plane and the next one taking off. And I'm not overly confident, especially as my speed for the 100 metres now is probably the same as the Olympic gold medal winning time for the marathon. So don't forget to check out the latest news and articles over at labiotech.eu, and I hope wherever in the world you are, you have a great week ahead. Thanks for listening, and that you'll join us next time for another Beyond Biotech.